for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. has called on the international community to be more generous in giving urgently needed aid to Pakistan's flood victims. 20 million people have been displaced. The death toll is expected to go far beyond the current 1,500 who've lost their lives. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the humanitarian crisis in Pakistan, Mawid Yousif of the Institute, the U.S. Institute of Peace. Molly Kinder of the Center for Global Development, and Paul Robey of Georgetown University. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. This is clearly a disaster of monumental depth and breadth, and what the U.S. and other countries do about it remains to be seen. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Mawid, if I could start with you, I know you've just spent 2 weeks in Pakistan. Describe what you've seen there.
I think I'm at a loss of words, frankly. I think this is one of the few disasters where I've seen reality being worse than what the media has projected. The damage is simply colossal, and there are regions where nobody's been able to reach. Rescue efforts are not reaching areas which are far-flung, which are flooded to the point where, you know, except helicopters, nothing can really get to people. There's still people stranded without any assistance. I mean, this is going to take weeks and weeks just to do the relief part of it.
How did this begin? Was it simply torrential rains out of season, and now you have the rainy season approaching?
No, Pakistan is a flood-prone country. It is a country based on canal agriculture. Reservoirs are short in number. The dams, you know, there's been a huge political issue, but they haven't been able to get to the point where they have enough storage capacity. This is very much seasonal rain, but the rainfall has been way more than it usually is. And the other sort of thing about this flooding is that this is not in pockets. Pakistan gets flooded in pockets every year, but this has been throughout the country, right from the north down to the very south and into the ocean. The country is flooded. So, I mean, the scale of the flooding is the real problem, not the flooding itself, which the country is fairly used to.
And tell me about the government's reaction.
You know, the government has responded not nearly as fast as perhaps people would have liked. But to be fair, I mean, I saw what was going on in Pakistan. Any developed country would have had difficulty coping with this challenge. So I blame the government only to a point. The disaster is just too huge to manage. And I think the Pakistani government is right in coming out and saying that we need as much assistance as possible.
However, I gather there has been quite a lot of criticism of President Zardari. Initially, he was in Europe visiting. He did not make any attempt to get back quickly. What's the feeling there among the people themselves?
No, I think they're very bitter. I mean, the Zardari visit did get a lot of negative publicity, as it should have, frankly. But now the government is more and more out there. They're visible. Media is, you know, seeing them go into the flood-stricken areas. It may have come a little late, but it has come. The real problem, frankly, is that they're going and making these promises, but there's nothing really to back it up. So the helplessness of people is making them very, very bitter towards the government and, by extension, frankly, towards the international community.
Mawid Yousif, he's South Asia advisor, manager of the Pakistan program for the U.S. Institute of Peace. Molly Kinder, what about the aid going into Pakistan? Are people getting what they need?
Diane, I think this is the most important question for the international community.
My impression is that the international response has been, up until now, stunningly anemic. We have seen a very slow response of donor countries to the UN's urgent appeal for $459 million, which is just to get people in Pakistan through the next 3 months. This is just the beginning. I mean, once we turn the page on this immediate aftermath, we're going to see staggering numbers for what the rebuilding process will take. But just right now, in this imminent disaster, what we've seen from the international community is just not nearly enough.
Why?
You know, and I will caveat that and say that I'm encouraged to read that the numbers are now reaching about half of that appeal. But that's still, I mean, this is weeks after this has begun and, you know, a catastrophe unlike what we've seen. And when we look at the international response compared to the most recent disasters, such as the Haiti earthquake, the tsunami, I was in Pakistan working on the 2005 earthquake for the World Bank. And the numbers we're seeing is just so much weaker. And I would explain that in several ways. First, you know, one I think is the psychology of floods, and there's been a lot of discussion of this, meaning when we think about the individual charitable response, I mean, flooding is not an imminent disaster like an earthquake. It doesn't terrify us in the same way. I mean, I think the tsunami just, you know, terrified our imaginations of, can you imagine being on a beach and suddenly this wave subsumes you. I think the flooding has come slower. It's hard for us to wrap our mind around what one-fifth of a country that most Americans have never seen before. I mean, if you can't picture what a map of Pakistan looks like without a flood, it's hard to sort of wrap your mind around just what damaging that would look like with a flood. So I think part of it is the nature of a flood, but it definitely has to be more than that, because we've also seen donor countries slow to respond. And I think there's some fatigue coming on the heels of so many other disasters here at home and internationally. You know, I also, to be honest, I think Pakistan suffers from an image problem. It's always in the news, but not for good reasons. The image we often hear in the media of Pakistan is one of terrorism and WikiLeaks and Al-Qaeda, and we rarely hear a good news story. So I think the combination of all these factors have limited the response, but it's, in my mind at least, it's unjustified. I think
how important do you think is the perception that perhaps if aid goes in the form of money,
yes,
it will simply disappear?
You know, I think that that's a perceptions problem and less of a reality problem just when we're talking about this moment of humanitarian relief. Pakistan's government, for many good reasons, does not have a very good reputation for good governance. As Moeed was just discussing, to some degree, the response has been disappointing. So I think that might limit people's reaction. But in reality, what we're talking about is a humanitarian response where international partners on the ground are leading those efforts for on behalf of us. So when the United States is giving money to Pakistan right now, it's not going to the government of Pakistan necessarily. It's going to the International Red Cross or the UN agencies, these same Oxfams of the world that responded to other humanitarian disasters. So when we turn to the longer rebuilding, this will be an issue. But right now, my impression is that people should feel confident giving their money to an international organization just as they did in other countries.
Molly Kinder, Senior Policy Analyst, Manager of U.S. Development Strategy in Pakistan for the Center for Global Development. Paul Ropi, what are the immediate health risks facing the people of Pakistan?
Diane, I think we're looking, well, first of all, let's say that nothing is inevitable if the right things are done at the right time. Most things can be avoided. We're yet to see this all play out, of course, but we are looking potentially at what could be a perfect storm in infectious disease in Pakistan as this plays itself out over the next several weeks, several months. As you mentioned early in the show, we're just about entering the peak monsoon season. So even though it's a poor choice of words, perhaps, normally we would be expecting a huge uptick in cholera, gastroenteritis, and malaria.
Normally,
even without the floods. And what I think many people may not know is over the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years, we've been seeing very significant increases in these three categories of disease for other reasons that are not connected to these floods directly. So there's already been a significantly growing infectious disease crisis in Pakistan, and these floods are only going to make that incredibly worse in the next 3 weeks to so.
When we hear about the 1,500 lives lost, have they been lost directly because of the flooding itself or because of the development of disease, or do we know?
I think we don't know. I mean, I'm not on the ground in any kind of communication expert or communication system. I'm not a communications expert, but my instinct is that that 1,500 has to be a low-ball estimate.
How does cholera develop?
Cholera is a bacterial disease. It's not transmitted human-to-human directly, but it is transmitted through the fecal matter, the diarrhea that comes with a case of cholera. Poor water sanitation, poor quality of drinking water, then allows the bacteria to pass from person to person through contaminated drinking water primarily. So the bacterium, it's a bacterium that's rather easily cured with one dose of antibiotics, or the symptoms can be relieved completely with proper rehydration therapy. So it's an easy disease to treat, but it's transmitted very, very rapidly in situations where we have poor water sanitation and contaminated drinking water.
Paul Ropy, he's co-director of the Center for Infectious Disease at Georgetown University, professor of chemistry at Georgetown University Medical Center. Short break. When we come back, we'll talk further. Take your calls. Welcome back. We're talking about the devastation in Pakistan because of the enormous flood and the potential for even more rain as the monsoon season is upon us. Moeed Youssef is here in the studio. He's with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Molly Kinder is at the Center for Global Development. Paul Ropy is with the Infectious Disease Center at Georgetown University. And we are going to open the phone shortly, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's a message from Facebook, which says, I wonder if they can use some of the billions in the war on terror they've already received from the U.S. I wonder how much of the aid they will now receive will now get siphoned off by politicians, the ISI, and the military. Moeed, that's always the concern.
Sure. I think, as Molly said, there's a serious image problem that this country suffers from. But I think we've really got to look deeper and look at this as a real human tragedy and a human crisis. The person on the ground in Pakistan who's affected is just as in need as anybody else in the world who would be affected by such a crisis. I think that's the mindset we should go by. As far as, you know, money leaking in Pakistan, yes. I mean, again, the governance is not a strong point of this government. But the fact of the matter is none of the money that's gone towards terrorism, fighting terrorism, can be used for this. It's being used up and more is needed even there. Also, there are ways which are being now sort of developed, and this bilateral aid doesn't necessarily need to go to the government of Pakistan. In fact, it won't. It would go to international partners, other organizations who can spend this more effectively and transparently. So I think there are ways to do this. We just need to keep an open mind and take this as a human tragedy more than as a political issue.
Here's an email from Jane in Salem, Massachusetts. She says, it seems we've been hearing lots of negative things about Pakistan. I suppose this accounts for some of the lack of enthusiasm for assistance in their problems. But personally, she says, I am committed through my church to try to repair the terrible damage in Haiti, and that minimizes my ability to help elsewhere, Molly.
You know, I think that this point about, we would call that donor fatigue to some degree. You can talk about it at a country level, but you can talk about it at a personal level. And we are so close on the heels of the Haiti earthquake, where I know personally my Facebook newsfeed was just full of friends making appeals for people to donate, throwing fundraising parties. A lot of my friends have gone to Haiti to work on that crisis. You know, so there is a sense that people really open their hearts and their wallets for some of these recent catastrophes. We also saw in our own country recent devastation in the south. And again, people open their hearts and their wallets. So I think that is a real concern. I also think, though, this is one of the many reasons why I feel strongly that the United States government should be doing more. There's no country in the world that matters more to our security at home than Pakistan. We have so many interests there. And on top of that, it's an enormous humanitarian disaster.
How much has the U.S. given thus far?
Thus far, as of yesterday, USAID reported that the U.S. gave $90 million.
Out of the $459 million that the U.N. had requested.
Correct. It doesn't directly go to that appeal. Some of that is in-kind contributions like helicopters and whatnot that I'm not sure counts for that. But a large, if you look at where that money from the U.S. is going, a lot of that is going to U.N. agencies who are providing relief on the ground. My personal feeling is that we can and we should do much more than that. We've already given $1.5 billion a year already committed to Pakistan for longer-term development. And for many reasons we give that aid, right now we're in a crisis. My bottom line recommendation is the U.S. should take half that tab from the U.N. and pay for it. Just take a majority stake. So doing at least double to triple what we're seeing right now.
Here's an email from Brian in Ferndale, Michigan. He says it gives one pause for the international community to raise $500 million for rebuilding in Pakistan when Pakistan continues to have a ridiculous nuclear arms program. Perhaps the international community can buy the nuclear program, shut it down, and let Pakistan use the funds to support their people. Moeed.
I would say forget it. I think that's a very, very close to heart issue for Pakistan and Pakistanis in general. There is a security environment they live in, and they believe that, you know, this is their ultimate sort of security guarantee. The fact of the matter is countries don't think like that. I mean, when crises hit, there is not a quid pro quo between giving up something in national security to deal with something else. Countries have enough sort of self-fulfilling sort of responsibilities in that sense to their people. They think it's necessary. There's ego attached to it. You know, Pakistanis don't get aid from the Indians. Indians are known not to get it from the Pakistanis. So I think it's not that simple. And I would basically see this as a non-starter, frankly.
Paul Rovey, during the break, we were talking about the kinds of diseases that Pakistanis will face. You said you did not think cholera was the most serious problem they'll face.
No, ma'am. I mean, I think in terms of being able to treat it, it's more approachable than some of the other diseases we're going to be looking at. So the big three, to my thinking, will be cholera, malaria, which comes in two different types in Pakistan, unlike most other regions around the globe where you might only have one type of malaria. And then a various spectrum of gastroenteritis syndromes of one sort or another caused by different viruses, different bacteria, and even parasites. So there's a whole spectrum of different diseases. Some of these are much easier to control than others. Some of them are easier to treat than others. So we're rolling the dice a bit. We don't quite know what we're going to see. But my guess is cholera may not turn out to be the biggest challenge.
Paint the picture for us, Moeed and Molly. Help us to understand where these people who've been inundated by water are going. How can they get even food, even shelter, even any kind of medical assistance?
What I saw in Pakistan, there are basically three ways that the government is trying to deal with this. One is that people who are stranded, the food supplies are being dropped by helicopters, basically sustenance for a few days before the water recedes to the point that they can be reached and pulled out. Second, the armed forces have set up a number of camps in Pakistan, in drier areas, where people are being asked to evacuate before the flood really hits the town. And people who manage to do that then find spaces there. The third ones are urban dwellers, people in cities who are fairly well-to-do and can actually find their own means to relocate, whether to relatives, whether to other cities, etc. But the real problem, the majority, frankly, are people who are either stranded or are in camps. And there, the kind of support that is coming in is simply not enough. I mean, the scale of the damage is too much to cope with.
So it's 20% of the country that is currently underwater, is that correct?
Larger than the size of England, is completely underwater at this point. That's the kind of situation.
Staggering.
Absolutely.
Staggering. And the people who were in those areas, their homes have been completely wiped out.
Not only homes. The infrastructure is gone. Roads are gone. Bridges are gone, so they can't reach where they have to reach. More importantly, land demarcations have disappeared. Now, for an agricultural country where, you know, subsistence agriculture is being practiced in the Indus Valley region, when you lose land demarcations, what you've really got at your hands is a grassroots political problem, where now who's going to tell you where your land was? Mm. So land mafias, land grabbers, you know, all sorts of problems are going to hit once this water recedes.
There is great concern about the Taliban moving in.
Not so much to me, frankly. I think, yes, militants always prey on the miseries of people. They did in the 2005 earthquake as well. They're going to do it now. But I don't really see this. You know, Pakistanis on their minds at this point, Taliban probably is a secondary issue. The real issue is getting support to them. And the quicker you get support, the more content people are, the less likely militants are to fill the vacuum.
Molly, you talked about the fact that you'd like to see the United States contribute half that $459 million that the UN has asked for. How much have other countries contributed thus far?
The U.S., the United States has the largest commitment of any country. So $90 million is the most of any single country. The second biggest donation or contribution is from the United Kingdom. They're at about half that number. And then what is really startling is that many countries that are friends of Pakistan or very wealthy countries are giving very small amounts.
Like?
So, for example, we're not seeing big commitments from China, from Saudi Arabia, countries that have historically had strong relationships. And in fact, I recall from 2005 in the earthquake, we saw actually big contributions from those countries. European countries, we're seeing small donations from France, for example, some of these major countries that we normally see participating. So when you look at the total, the most recent figure I've seen is about half. We have now, the entire international community has reached about half of what the UN has asked for. The U.S.'s contribution in comparison to other countries is large. I think compared to its capacity to give and what it has at stake in that country, I think we don't see nearly enough.
Why not China? Why not Saudi Arabia?
You know, I'm puzzled over those same questions. I don't know if there's a sense that that money will come at the even more enormous task of rebuilding. I think when in about the next 10 days, the World Bank's team that is going in right now to assess the damage and needs, which is something I did in 2005, they sent in a team to say, this is the devastation. This is how much it's going to cost to rebuild. And then Pakistan will put out an appeal for partners to come forward. I suspect you'll see so right now we're just talking about the humanitarian response. Pretty soon we're going to see an absolutely staggering bill for the reconstruction efforts. And in that sense, in the past, China and Saudi Arabia have given more to Pakistan on the earthquake. But I'm puzzled by this slow response. And I on Thursday, there's going to be a UN summit where I think there's a real opportunity for the United States and all sorts of other donor countries to commit more. And my hope is that we will see much bigger contributions.
Paul Rothe, those amounts, what would you expect to go for medical supplies?
That's a really good question. We should remember that infectious diseases know no country boundaries. So whatever is going to be spent is probably going to be well below what we should be spending. Another, getting back to Moeed's point about the displacement and the refugees, another key factor here is that many of these folks are moving from regions where malaria is normally non-endemic, so they don't have any pre-immunity to malaria, and they're moving into crowded situations with poor water sanitation where malaria is endemic and is just beginning to pick up in terms of its peak transmission season. So we're not just going to see increased incidence of malaria, we're going to see increased mortality.
Paul Rothe of Georgetown University. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Waco, Texas. Good morning, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to make a comment. First of all, I'm from Pakistan. And I believe that the reason the international community is not helping or they're so reluctant, simply because the image of Pakistan government is so bad. The government is so corrupted that people are reluctant. I mean, look at what the president was doing when this huge incident happened. He was making those foreign trips. And in that time, there was some incident happened, and then one channel in Pakistan showed the incident that when somebody threw a shoe on President Zardari, the Pakistan government shut down the channel. So I totally believe the government is so corrupted. I mean, people know that their donation will be wiped, and although there are so many efforts are totally independent, but no, the government won't have been so far.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Moeed.
I'll say again, I think there is a perception issue here as well. As I said, a lot of this money actually can go directly to either international organizations or to reputed welfare organizations in Pakistan. It doesn't have to go. In fact, most of it is not going to the government. So donors have to keep this in mind when this happens. The other thing I'll say, frankly, is this country is way too much under the microscope. And, so when you have crises elsewhere, maybe these kind of issues don't come up as much. But because Pakistan is in the limelight, these things get sort of blown out of proportion. Again, the message simply is that this is a human tragedy which can be dealt with by bypassing the government if that's really what people want.
Paul Rothe.
Yeah, I'd point out that before the floods, 200,000 to 250,000 Pakistani children were dying of diseases that are basically caused by poor water sanitation. They're not part of the government. They are just kids, and they're dying of diseases that we can cure with fairly routine technology if the right assistance gets to the right places quickly enough.
Now, we are going to have some websites on our website through which people can contribute. We'll have those websites up as soon as possible. What's at the top of your list, Molly?
I've always donated to Oxfam for almost any international tragedy. So I have a lot of faith in Oxfam. So that would be my top.
How about you, Moeed?
I think in Pakistan, perhaps the single most reputed entity is the EDHI Foundation. EDHI is how it's spelled. Islamic Relief is another one, which does a lot of work. And this time, actually, something very interesting has happened. The government of Pakistan and the opposition have come together and have set up a commission which is going to be run, and the money is going to be managed by reputed, transparent people who do welfare and activities, philanthropists. So that may be another option for people to go to.
Moeed Youssef, he's South Asia advisor and manager of the Pakistan program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more of your questions, comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count is a state-by-state look at child well-being and the important role of data at aecf.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The Healing Power of Dogs, the founder of a service dog training organization on matching dogs to children and adults with disabilities. How seeing the world through a dog's eyes can benefit all of us. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And as we talk about the flood in Pakistan, here's an email from Marjorie, who says, "My family resides in Pakistan. The donated food packages have already made it to the black market. Just before the flooding, merchants increased their food prices to take advantage of sales for the Ramadan evening meals. Is there a way to request the imams jointly direct the merchants and black market profiteers to step up and honestly help victims of the flood? The society is riddled with dishonesty and greed." Moeed.
I think it's a brilliant idea. One of the things, I've been a strong critic of Pakistan not having used its media and its public information channels positively as much as it could. And this is a great opportunity for people to come out and say that in this need of our, you basically get rid of your norm of raising these prices and all the black market activity, and let's do something for the people there.
And here's a caller in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Tim.
Yes, Diane. Some of your panelists have mentioned specific groups, I think, you could make donations to that they know make a difference. But who's got the boots on the ground that are really making a difference now, that if you want to support the people in Pakistan, you can see you can get the quickest, biggest bang for your buck?
Molly?
I think we have the fact that the flooding is coming on the heels of last year's crisis in Swat Valley means that there are, actually are a lot of organizations who've already been doing wonderful work dealing with these internally displaced people in the Swat Valley, which is where the flooding first really struck. So there are actually wonderful NGOs that we've all heard of. So again, this, Moeed had some wonderful suggestions of Pakistani institutions, but I think most of the UN agencies, International Red Cross, International Crisis Group, Save the Children, Oxfam, they're really doing tremendous work on the ground. And if you want to increase your confidence in donating, if you go to some of their websites, they actually have blogs talking about what these aid workers are seeing, what they're doing. And I think it will make those of us who want to make a difference increase our confidence.
And the photographs are devastating. Paul Ropi.
Yeah, another good thing to think about doing, in the late 60s, early 70s, malaria was nearly wiped out in Pakistan and it's come roaring back. The UN, which is a non-governmental agency, of course, is running a program called Nothing But Nets, one word, nothingbutnets.com. And for a dollar, you can send a malarial bed net that will prevent the transmission of malaria to at least one child, prevent maybe up to 10 other cases of malaria. Run by the UN, they've already been there for a while because of the vastly increased incidence of malaria even prior to this. So there are a number of organizations doing this.
And we've had several emails like this from Michael, who says, is it true that Pakistan turned down aid from India? If so, then perhaps things aren't as bad as the Pakistani government paints it.
Last I know, India had made an offer, but I didn't hear that they turned it down, although they hadn't accepted it either. You know, you've really got to understand the security dynamic there and the way these two countries operate. It's really unfortunate, but you go back in history, India was struck by a major earthquake in Ahmedabad some years ago, and this was a huge political issue whether to accept aid or not, and the Pakistani case is the same. So while I completely agree it's very, very unfortunate, I wouldn't the conclusion to be drawn is not that things are not as bad as people are saying. They're actually much worse. It's just that there is a very narrow-minded political vision in that part of the world when it comes to Pakistan-India relations.
To Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
You know, I've always thought that to have friends, you have to be a friend. And I'm not quite sure if Pakistan has any friends in the world. Right now, we're supposed to be a trusted ally of theirs, and we're obviously not. Everybody knows about the ISI and a lot of the other problems that we've had. So I think a lot of the people here in America just and in the world just don't trust Pakistan as a country and as a government. And also, I've heard that we were supposed to have some Navy people flying in helicopters and relief missions to Pakistan. How's that being done? I didn't think we were supposed to be in that country, flying our flag.
There have been some helicopters donated towards the medical relief efforts because it's critically important to get people suffering from cholera and other diseases to the right places to get them treated quickly. So I do know that there's been, I think, about a dozen or so helicopters from the military.
Fact, the military has a long history of supporting humanitarian disasters, even in Pakistan. In 2005, in the earthquake, we had Chinook helicopters. And, in fact, Pakistanis greeted that military presence with very open arms. So there is some concern, I think, about the presence of military boots on the ground. But my impression is that the reception is so well received because of the needs. And to the very valid point about perceptions and friendship, I think as much as we in the United States might be skeptical of Pakistan's friendship toward us, and in Pakistan, even more so, there's a question of whether or not the United States really is a friend of Pakistan. Right now, we're giving a lot of aid. If you look at the past 20 to 30 years, we have been a very fair-weather friend of Pakistan. We had huge amounts of aids during the Cold War, and then we cut it all off. We're up and down. We're up and down. And this really is a moment for the United States. Our country has decided, our leaders have decided, that it is essential to our national security to change our relationship with Pakistan and not just have a military presence, but to support their civilian government and to demonstrate to the Pakistani people that we care. So this, I think this disaster is a moment for the United States to reach out and really make that impression. Depression.
To Boca Raton, Florida. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
My question is, what are the chances of more countries from the Middle East, let's say Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey perhaps, some of the countries with the better economies in the Middle East coming together to help donate as well?
Molly.
You know, I think that's a great question. And I was in Pakistan in 2005 after the earthquake, and we had a major donor conference. And it was the Middle Eastern countries, exactly the countries that were just mentioned, Turkey, Saudi Arabia. These countries really stepped up in the aftermath of that disaster. So I think there's a huge potential. These are natural friends of Pakistan, and they have the capacity to give. We haven't yet seen it, but again, I think there are more opportunities, and I think the onus is also on the United States and other countries to reach out and do some diplomatic outreach to try to encourage that aid.
During the break, didn't you mention that Afghanistan has actually donated?
Right. I mean, I was really struck by this. Yesterday, I sent out a tweet that Afghanistan had written a check for $1 million to Pakistan. And actually, if you compare that to other much wealthier countries, it makes some of those other checks look quite small. But it is a striking gesture. And you're seeing that even Algeria, I just saw this morning, had given $1 million.
Here's an email from John in Dayton, Ohio. One question left unanswered by media coverage of the flood. How is the holy month of Ramadan affecting how Islamic Pakistanis and the international Islamic community cope with the disaster? Moeed.
No, I think it's just made things tougher for the people. I mean, this is the month where people fast. You know, there's no eating or drinking from sunrise to sunset. So under the circumstances that you find 14 million people who are affected, this is hardly the time for them to be going through this. And so I think it's really made it difficult. One would think, though, that given that this is the holy month of Ramadan, charity would be more forthcoming.
But how are the people in the cities who are wealthier, who are safe, how are they reaching out to help their less fortunate neighbors?
I think this is one of the most positive things about Pakistani society. It's got one of the highest private philanthropy rates in the world. So the Pakistani well-to-do always come out in such situations and, you know, donate a lot of money to these welfare organizations. And that's really what's spearheading the effort even to this point. The international sort of pledges are only starting to trickle in. So the initial, you know, first 2 or 2.5 weeks have really been sustained by Pakistani effort.
And more than money, how have they helped?
I think there is also this idea in Pakistan of a community welfare. So, you know, people do go out and do a lot for their communities, even normally. And this is a time when they would want to do more. The problem really this time is accessibility. I remember 2005, you couldn't drive a car on the roads in the north of the country because there were so many people wanting to take relief. The problem now is, how do you get there?
What a terrible situation. To West Bloomfield, Michigan. Good morning, Steve.
How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you, sir. Go right ahead.
Okay, first off, before I tell you my story that happened in 2005 in Pakistan, I'd say it's a tragedy that anybody goes hungry or that anybody dies for something that should be easily available. In 2005... I do business in Asia, but in 2005, a friend of mine who's formerly in the Pakistani Armed Service asked me to try and locate some generators to put on the side of the mountain where they'd had the earthquake. And I located 3 generators that would have been enough power for 3 villages. Very quickly put together a bid. The supplier said that he could have those generators on the side of the mountain with a crew and do the wiring within 3 days. We never got an answer, and what my friend, that's ex-Pakistani military, finally told me later on was that a French company came to the person in Pakistan that controlled the bid and gave them a couple of Mercedes. And I honestly don't know if the people ever got the generators.
No, we.
I'm not surprised at all.
The problem is, people fear, is the stuff really going to get to the people that need
it? Sure. Sure.
I mean, as I'm not surprised at all. I'm sure this would have happened. This is a serious problem. There's no doubt about that. The point comes back to what we had discussed earlier, and that is that perhaps perceptions are larger than reality in this case. And while things are just as bad as people think, there is a lot of money that will get to the people. And as I said, if government is the problem, one can easily bypass them in such situations. There are outlets which must be used.
On the question of India offering monies and Pakistan not accepting, Tom in Ashland, Oregon recalls that the U.S. did not accept aid from Cuba when Katrina occurred. Let's go to Worcester, Massachusetts. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I just want to make a point about one of the factors in the United States not participating very well. You have the leaders of one of the two major political parties in this country trying to demonize the creation of mosques and demonize all things Islamic in the United States. This creates an atmosphere which is not conducive to people giving money.
Molly.
You know, I think that's a very fair point. I really am hopeful that in these next few days that our leaders, Hillary Clinton is going to be at an event in New York on Thursday. I hope to see more messages from our top leaders explaining to the American people why this matters to us. I saw a wonderful speech by the Deputy Prime Minister of England making an appeal to the international community to give more. It's a bit of a poison environment to some degree right now in the United States, and I really put the onus a bit on our policymakers to reach out.
Molly Kinder of the Center for Global Development, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Where do we go from here, Moeed? What do you see happening, and how has the government's response to this whole crisis affected their stability?
Diane, we're looking at 5 to 10 years. This is going to take 5 to 10 years before Pakistan comes back to where it was in terms of the losses. So we're talking of the humanitarian intervention at this point. This is just the start. So my message really is there is a long-term issue here which needs to be dealt at on a sustainable level by the international community and by Pakistani government and Pakistanis themselves. As far as the political stability is concerned, you know, the government is already fairly weak, and this is one further sort of blow to it.
And you already have Islamist militants attacking police.
Sure, although I don't think that was linked to the flooding as much. That was the activity that they've continued otherwise. I don't think the government is going to fall. I don't think there's going to be any change in the setup. But yes, any such thing where the government doesn't perform in an environment where they're already criticized a lot, you know, is not going to go in their favor.
And to you, Paul, what does the lack of food signal for the future?
That's only going to further exacerbate all of the health concerns in Pakistan, of course. Look, the fight against infectious disease is an international effort that involves a number of non-governmental agencies. This is a fight that goes above and beyond the political issues, the economic issues, and so on.
And, of course, Molly, we're hearing that people are becoming not only more desperate, but more violent.
Yes, I think this is a real issue. I mean, when I think about this, you know, I grew up in Buffalo, New York. This is about 20 cities like Buffalo, New York, away from their homes, lost their homes, facing an imminent humanitarian disaster. They're not getting the aid they need. Can you imagine if I was in Buffalo and there was a flood and nothing was reaching me? Of course I would be disenchanted. I'd be upset with the government. This is a real problem. It's a real problem not only for Pakistan, but for the United States. So I think there's an urgent need for the United States, for individuals, for the international community to try our best to meet those needs. And then, as Moeed said, I think once we turn the page on this and start thinking about how do we put this country back together, it's just going to be an enormous task.
Do you expect Secretary Clinton to talk about this tomorrow?
I certainly do. I think this is a huge issue. I hope to see leadership coming from Secretary Clinton on this.
Molly Kinder of the Center for Global Development, Paul Ropey of Georgetown University, Medical Center and Moeed Yusuf of the U.S. Institute of Peace. As I said earlier, we'll have a number of potential sites for donations on our website. I hope you'll think seriously about helping people who are desperately in need. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.